Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on this Sunday night, and as I mentioned earlier in the program, I'm going to dip back a bit into my childhood for this guest, because he was a frequent visitor on a show that I used to watch when I was a kid. Well, not quite such a tiny little kid, and probably I was already a little older than I should have been when I was still watching this show, but it was called The Patchwork Family, and it was CBS TV's version of their Sunday morning show before they even had a Sunday morning show. It was treating kids like a bit smarter and a bit more creative than perhaps we all were, but I rather liked that. And one of the guests that they had on there was a fella who came a little bit from the musical theater world and just playing from the music world, was an expert in all sorts of instruments, and also wrote some of his own songs. And I found him just really charming, and the songs very catchy. Couldn't get them out of my head. So now this is the expiation. This is the way that I can finally, you know, download the songs out of my brain and into the ozone, because I have on the phone with me, all the way from California, Mr. Paul Tracy.
Well, good evening to you, Dave.
Yeah, that was a rather bizarre intro. Sorry about that, but very, very happy to have you with us in the neighborhood, Paul.
Thank you.
So that was the Patchwork Family, which I guess goes back to the early 1970s.
Probably right, because I moved out to California in 76, so it was just, yeah, and I'd only moved into New York after our show closed on Broadway. That was in 68. So I was only there for a period of 7 years. It must be in the early 70s.
So actually, since we're already bringing that back, why don't we even trace it back a little bit? Unfortunately, it was a little before my time when Paul was on Broadway in a South African-based show called Wait a Minim. Why don't you explain how that came about and what that was?
Well, that's a wonderful story, because I was a chicken farmer, and my brother was working with my dad in African music. That was our sort of family business, the study of African music. And a producer came to the two of us. We were just singing folk songs as the Tracy Brothers on occasional things. And the producer came to us and said, do you think you could put on a show? Because he had a lease of a theater which desperately needed to be filled. And, we said, no, I don't think we can. But he encouraged us to go to the theater one night and sing our entire repertoire of folk songs. We had a big collection of folk songs, because my brother had been the chair of the Folk Song Society at Oxford.
Oh.
And they collected all sorts of international folk music. And so we sang all our songs, and during some of our more serious numbers, the producer and his friend started giggling.
Oh.
And we thought, what on earth is going on? It turned out that it became the format for this show, which was to take national groups and present them through their folk music and their dance and make fun of them because of their national characteristics. This was so politically incorrect, it was almost impossible to do today.
Yes, so for example, what would you do in the show?
Well, for example, the Germans, you would sing a song like, oh, du wunderschön, du wunderschön, you know, very sort of cheery beer song, and then suddenly the three guitar players in the show would suddenly stop playing, turn their guitars into machine guns, and riddle the audience with bullets. And then
God!
Go on. Just joking.
Wonderful
stuff.
You really did that on the... My God, what did you do for the other nationalities?
Oh, well, the Japanese. Look, I don't think it's any secret that the Japanese are wonderfully polite, but incredibly cruel. So the combination was just dying to be mocked. And so we had a scene where we had a man singing the Japanese folk song, and he's been served tea, which is a very formal sort of thing. And he drinks the first cup of tea, and then he goes on singing, and then the woman offers him a second cup of tea. He doesn't really want it, you can see in his face.
Right.
But he accepts, and then she offers him another cup of tea, and finally, you know, he's had it, and he takes the tea pot and he stuffs it down her throat. stupid stuff like that, but very funny. No spoken words.
Really?
Except when we got to the South African political scene, because this all started in Johannesburg. And
well,
the days of apartheid. And funnily enough, you could say anything you liked in theater, because they knew that very few people went to the theater. If you had radio or television, then you were censored. But we got away with saying almost anything in theater.
So
when we took the show overseas,
yeah,
anything that we had not said on stage in South Africa.
Well, how did you do, or how did you deal with the South African political situation in Wait a Minim? when you were doing it on stage. What was the bit or the sequence?
Dave, are you getting a big sound? Is it my phone or yours?
Sounds like your phone, although I guess you're having a little trouble hearing me.
Well, no, I wonder if I can just jiggle this thing briefly. If I lose you, will you...
I hope it's the phone you're talking about.
Hello, this is Paul Tracy, a wandering minstrel from California. We're on Dave's Gone By on WGBB. Let's carry on.
So, the question was...
Yes, how are we doing political... How did we do the political stuff?
Yeah.
What happened was that the government sent a couple of agents to watch our show and figure out if it was culturally worthy. And apparently it was.
Hmm.
We couldn't really believe that they didn't get the jokes about the government. But that's the way it works. And
but I'm curious.
Those like you, they charge you a terrible tax, which basically puts you out of business.
Oh, interesting. But when, I'm actually curious what the jokes were or how you... In other words, you said how you portrayed the Germans and the Japanese. How did you portray the South African government, literally, on stage? What did you do?
We had, like, the news, for example, and here comes the news. And I would be reading the news, and I would lean severely to one side, because our news was always slanted.
little stuff, cute stuff like that. You know?
Very visual.
Yeah.
Humor, yes. It was a marvelous... It was a wonderful show for us because we created it ourselves. The four of us in particular were the creators.
Right.
We had my brother and myself who played a lot of different instruments.
Is your brother still alive, by the way? Is your brother still around?
Yeah, yes, but he's in Africa.
Oh, wonderful. Cool.
He went back to working with my father. I actually took over the running of the library. That's the International Library of African Music. My dad created that 53 years ago now. And then my brother took over about 30 years ago and actually moved it from close to Johannesburg, where my dad had it, and he moved in with Rhodes University, which was a smart move because my dad wasted many years of his life just trying to raise funds to keep the library going.
Didn't he also have a radio station of some sort?
At Rhodes?
Or your father had a radio station.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes, he ran the studios in Durban, the South African Broadcasting Corporation, and that was his position... Well, from before the war, I'm talking about the early 30s, right through the war, up till 47, when he quit and went into African music full-time.
Wow.
And he actually signed up to be, you know, on the in the war, on the Allied side. With the South Africans were somewhat suspect about the war, but he signed up for the Allies, and they said no.
He signed up in 1946, which was a little, you know...
No.
Hedged his bets a little bit, didn't he?
No, he signed up before the war.
All right.
39, and... that's before. A little joke about Americans there, of course. It was 1939 when the war started.
Oh, yeah.
And he was told, no, your job is to look after the radio waves, because this was long before other sophisticated ways of sending messages, and there were submarines off the coast. And so he had to listen to everybody who was on his radio, making sure they were not sending messages to the submarines off the coast, and he in fact did catch one man who, for 2 weeks in a row, used the same text for his sermon. And my father realized that was very suspicious.
It was code?
It was code. Yes. Well,
wow.
Yes, it's a very easy sort of code, you know, chapter so and so, verse so and so, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Ooh.
You get all sorts of clues.
And so, were they able to find it, or they just shut down the broadcast? I mean, what do you?
I was very young, and I don't remember how the story ended.
Oh,
but we didn't see much. We didn't see much of the war. We saw a lot of the troops came around there. They had R&R in Durban, where I was living, and we had one airplane that came across in the middle of the war. We all dove into our dugout shelters, but that was about it. And I stayed there and left in 47 because my parents split up and had my education in England.
And where did you go? Were you Rhodes or Oxford, or where did you go?
No, I went to normal sort of schooling and up until 18, and after that I went to what they call the University of the Bush.
Oh.
Which means...
So you met some women. No, I don't know what that means.
The University of the Bush. That means I taught myself everything that I find useful today when I went back to live on the farm with my dad in Africa.
Oh.
That's when I started doing radio work myself. My father encouraged me to get some of my folk songs together and have my own little program on radio. Then at one stage, I had my own 15 minutes a week for children.
Oh, lovely, yeah.
I write the script every week. I love doing it. It's called The Nutcrackers.
And children has kind of carried through your career on some level, because you were doing some folk, obviously some folk music for adults and some cultural folk music and writing your own songs. But I think over the past bunch of years, you've concentrated more on children. Am I right about that?
You are right. I never wrote songs until my daughter was born, and that's about 37 years ago now. You know, I have a trouble with being English in that one doesn't talk about oneself in England. But I find that when I do shows in America, you cannot be personal enough. They want to hear every detail about your life.
Oh, yeah, totally.
But then I go back to England or to South Africa, and the reviews say, it's rather personal. Anyway, so it was when my daughter was born that finally I just had to let out some emotions and just...
Yeah, because you wrote a couple of songs about your daughter, about your wife. There's a very nice song about... it's sort of a blessing and a prayer for your car, where you're...
Oh,
you're
yes.
No, I mean, it's silly, but it's nice. It seems like it's going to be this western-y kind of song about a horse, and then you realize, no, it's about a car. He's talking about a red Mustang. And
that's
then you
right.
Realize,
that was my wife's... favorite. I mean, she was passionate about this car. It was a turbocharged, and she just loved it. And I realized that if I was going to get through to her, I would have to go through the car. So
or
I
at
was,
least through the back seat.
When she
no,
was away one weekend down in San Diego, and I just imagined that she was driving along down the coast of California, down to San Diego, past some of those snow-topped mountains on the inland side, and I was just encouraging the car to look after her and to drive her carefully and would the car make her coffee like I do and tell her stories at night. I mean, I was just really chastising the car and making sure that she got home safely.
I mean, it's a lovely way to approach a love song because it's obviously more about your wife and kid than it is about the car.
Well,
although maybe for you, the way you talk about the car, maybe it's also about the car.
Well, I mean, yeah, but unfortunately, the Mustang people never picked it up and never paid me a fortune. But there you go.
Oh, well, at least you're making enough money to buy a red Mustang.
Ah, maybe one day.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. We're talking with Paul Tracy, who is described from a place called the Tacoma Review. They said, Paul Tracy, folklorist, is an incredibly charming and talented pantomimist, guitarist, storyteller, composer, writer, and singer. All this may sound a bit much, but it only hits the high spots. And we're certainly finding that out today.
And it just shows you can't believe everything you see in writing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's from the Internet. So it probably means nothing at all. But you sound a little bit talented, so I might as well keep talking to you. Yeah, I got some time to kill. Now, in between here, while we were listening to your song, you were getting out a musical instrument. And it's funny, because even without provocation or without my prompting you, my next question to Paul Tracy is going to be, please explain, I never remember this, and I probably won't remember this after tonight, but what is the difference between a marimba and a kalimba?
Perhaps what you're saying, instead of marimba, which is a xylophone, perhaps you could be saying mbira, which is M-B-I-R-A. And mbira is the African word for the type of instrument which my father adapted into a kalimba.
Oh.
Now, the mbira is the generic term that all the musicologists have chosen for this family of instruments in Africa. And the kalimba is just an easier way of saying it. When my father developed this instrument, he decided he'd better have a name that people can say. And mbira is pretty tough.
Well, it's got like apostrophe in there. That's always annoying.
Right. Yeah. You have to agree first. Mbira. So he used kalimba. And kalimba is actually a nice word because the ka means little and the limba means music. Kalimba,
oh.
Music. And it's just a little box with stainless steel. Spring steel notes attached to the front. The particular model I have in my hands is called the treble, and it has 17 notes. It's a very sweet thing.
Oh.
Very simple to play with two thumbs.
Wow, we have treble right here in River City. That's wonderful.
All right.
Sorry about that. I apologize instantly for that joke.
We like musical jokes.
So that is a mabira that was turned into a kalimba by your dad.
Yes, he made it look sort of more Western, but he spent his life studying African music, and this was his attempt originally, not to be a big money making thing. Well, a small money making thing to keep money coming in, so he could keep researching African music. It became such a charming thing that now it's sort of worldwide, and people have stolen his idea, because he could never patent it very well, because it's basically a folk instrument. But his main contribution towards the instrument is in the redesign of the keyboard, because if you try to play a scale on a piano with two thumbs, you get tied up right away.
Right.
On this one, the scale starts on the left, moves to the right thumb, to the left, the right, left, right, left, right. And that means, with just two thumbs, you can play a pretty rapid scale. That, of course, Dave, is if you're all thumbs.
Thank you.
At least I found someone who recognizes the joke when one comes up.
Now, what would you say your contribution to musicology and musical instruments has been over the past couple of decades?
Well, minimal. But what I do, one of my shows I do for kids in schools is on Africa and the culture of Africa, and we hear enough bad news about Africa in the newspaper all the time. So my job is to talk about the good stuff that comes out of Africa, and there's so much good stuff that my dad found. I mean, he found it worthwhile making a study his whole life of African music and African culture. And so I'm presenting some of my dad's recordings of African music. I'm playing some of the instruments, demonstrating them. I'm telling one of the stories that my dad collected in Zimbabwe, great African stories. The same stories, actually, that came across with the slaves and turned into Brer Rabbit. But on the way over, unfortunately, all those slaves lost their original languages. They were forced to learn English. And language and music are so closely associated that they lost all the stories. And lost the music in the stories.
Right.
And Brer Rabbit doesn't have little songs in it, which all the African stories do, practically all of them. Some of the stories, they're coming slightly back into style. They were out of fashion for a while.
Is there a short one?
There was one about the tar baby.
You hear a word like that in America, and you'll automatically bristle, even though it's not supposed to,
Right. I mean, you've got to be so careful to be politically correct. But the tar baby in Africa, is instead of getting stuck in this tar, they use bird lime. And that's the stuff that you put on a branch, and a bird gets stuck in it.
Oh. Why would you do that?
If you want to eat the bird, you have to catch it.
Yeah, okay, that's a good point.
Protein starvation in Africa. You know, people need meat very badly.
So they would throw lime up onto the branches, and then the birds would get stuck, and they'd go up and pull the birds off and eat them.
Exactly right. Now, I've been having trouble in my backyard with squirrels.
Yeah?
They've been eating everything in my backyard here in California. And I've had all sorts of advice how to deal with them. My brother was the one who reminded me about bird lime. But I don't know of anyone who actually sells bird lime in California. And I don't think I want to argue with angry squirrel stuck in bird lime.
Yeah, what would you do once you got them up there? And it's like, okay, there's a squirrel, he's stuck. It'd be horrible. You just wait for them to be dead so you can pluck them off.
No, it would be actually hopeless. So I
look out your window every morning, and it's like, oh, the squirrels are dying today. This one has one more day. That one's dropping off.
Terrible.
What an image.
And they're so cute, the squirrels, but the damage they do, because I like to grow gourds in my garden here. People are amazed that I can grow gourds. They also have no idea that I can grow loofahs.
Really? I thought those were, like, underwater, because they're sponges.
Yeah, everyone does, because somebody stupidly named them loofah sponges. And so sponges grow in the ocean.
Right.
The loofahs grow, they look rather like cucumbers, and they grow on vines in the back garden.
Just like the gourds do.
Yeah,
but if the squirrels get at them, basically you're out of your gourds. So
exactly. Now, for 10 years, the squirrels had no idea that there were seeds inside the gourds. Then someone figured it out. One of those squirrels figured it out, and ever since then, I've hadn't had another gourd. They eat them before I can get them.
Oh my!
So that's why I have my favorite enemy today is the backyard squirrel.
Oh Lord. We're talking, by the way, with Paul Tracy about all sorts of things, as you can see. We're having a wonderful time. I wish we had a little more time. But I want to get back to a couple of things. First of all, the fact that you were on that TV show from my childhood. How did you get involved in CBS TV's The Patchwork Family?
I think maybe it started a little earlier when I was on out here we call it Channel 28. It's a public station in New York. And I was part of a little acting group that were acting out folk stories.
Oh.
And one day, the producers knew that we had folk songs. He said, "Do you have a song for our theme this week, which is wishing?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, I've got this great song. It's, oh, I wish I had the shepherd's lamb, the shepherd's lamb, the shepherd's lamb. I wish I had the shepherd's lamb and Katie from her father." And his, you know, nice old Irish tune.
Yeah.
He said to me, "No, I don't like it. Write another one." And I said, "Well, hang on a second. That was a folk song. I didn't write that." He said, "It's okay. Write another one." So I went home, and I wrote a wishing song. And came back the next day and sang it to him, and he liked it. "I wish I had a coat of silk the color of the sky." And it was a song that later Jim Henson picked up and put on The Muppet Show. And that was really nice because the Muppets in those days were playing to 130 countries, I think.
Right.
And so even today, I still get 5 cents from Nigeria once in a while.
You know, so do I, and there, no particular reason. No.
Royalties. I mean, there's nothing. Royalties, you know, because you feel like a king, that's why you get royalties.
Ooh, very nice.
There is a free lunch.
But I remember that the reason I most remember you, aside from demonstrating the instruments, was there was a song that you sang and played of your own composition on the show called Something's Missing. That I thought was so clever. I think it was about 8 years old. And yet, the melody stuck with me, and just the whole idea of it. Of
I got the idea
from world.
Who sent me the this name, Something's Missing. And in fact, it was the name of a racehorse in England.
Oh.
And she said, "Oh, I found this name. It sounds like a title for a song for Paul." So she sent me the title, and I wrote the song that went with it. And then she wrote to me later and said, "Something's Missing, it never wins." But it's done me very well, I must say. That's one of the songs I do keep singing.
Yeah, it's a very winning song, actually. We're going to play it to go out here with Paul Tracy. But I got one more question for you, and I guess I've got to kind of go to, I won't say something slightly negative, because it was a positive thing, but I assume you were in California when finally there was regime change in South Africa.
Uh-huh.
What were your feelings about that? Were you in contact with your family, making sure there were no riots and stuff? I mean, did you have mixed feelings, or how was it at that time?
Actually, it was quite brilliant. The fact that they could change power in the government without major bloodshed was a major triumph. And I give an incredible amount of credit to Mandela, who was, you know, just a world-class statesman. I wish we had more around like him today. I mean, even the current people in South Africa are simply not up to what he was. I mean, I admire him tremendously for having achieved that.
How often do you go back?
Not too often. My brother and I tend to meet in Europe because it's halfway for both of us.
Right, okay.
In California, it's the best part of 24 hours to fly there, and it's a killer on the body and the jet lag and everything.
Wow. But I'm certainly glad that you're in the States, and certainly if you're ever on the Northeast, you are welcome to come and visit the neighborhood with any instrument you bring. Well, you know, except your organ, but that's something else.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've been talking with the wonderful and delightful Paul Tracy. Thank you so much.
Pleasure, Dave.